Welcome to the future. Get ready to explore how spirituality and science will come together in the Age of Aquarius. Hosted by JC Nova.
Hey everyone. Today I'm talking with Elaine Casket. She's a psychologist and author of All the Ghosts in the Machine. It's about immortality in the digital age. When someone you love dies, they live on in your heart and mind, but so does their social media profile. In the afterlife, the digital footprint is transformed into a lasting legacy. But who owns all that information? Their photos, videos, comments? I think you'll be surprised, and probably even concerned. It's a very enlightening conversation. Now, on with the show. So I'm going to dive right in. What inspired you to write the book, All the Ghosts in the Machine?
All the Ghosts in the Machine is a kind of outcome of quite a few years of investigating stuff in this space. And as a psychologist by training, originally when I stumbled across this juxtaposition of death in the digital, it was shortly after I had joined Facebook myself, just as a user, and came across an in-memory-of page of someone who had died. And then also, because privacy settings were a lot less stringent at that time, I was able to see her in-life profile too, and my attention was immediately captured by the sorts of things that I was seeing there in terms of emerging practices and how people interacted differently with the two things. And in the years subsequent to that, I really spread out, got a bit outside of my lane, I guess, and became really interested in things like cybersecurity aspects, legal aspects, technical aspects, sociological aspects, all of which sit in their own fields. And there's lots of my colleagues who have expertise in those fields when it comes to death in the digital. But I kind of feel like I wanted to write All the Ghosts in the Machine because I wanted to bring all those bits together. I feel like it's really hard to understand the psychological experience of death, dying, grieving, mourning in a technologically mediated environment without having some kind of sense of how the security stuff impacts us psychologically, how the control impacts us, how the legal situation or the regulatory situation or lack thereof has an emotional or psychological impact on individuals. So I really needed the space. I'd written articles and I'd written blog posts and stuff like that, but I needed the space of a book to be able to delve into it in that really multi-stranded, multidisciplinary way that I really like talking about this subject in.
So how do you think social media has reshaped our experience when it comes to death and loss?
You know, this is such an interesting question because of a subtle assumption that I think is baked into the question and to a lot of questions about it. You actually phrase it a little bit differently. You just talk about shaping our experience. A lot of folks ask the question in a different way, which is, what is social media doing to us? How is it changing bereavement? How is it changing our experience of loss? Which is a really interesting techno-causal kind of frame where it kind of assumes social media is this monolithic force that has a predictable, reducible kind of impact that we can say, oh yes, look, it's having this effect. It kind of carries with it a lot of assumptions that maybe we carry in general about grief and mourning and the experience of loss, like there's some optimal or normal way of grieving, like technology can help or hinder that, and we should control the impact of technology on our emotional experience. And I think that what that glosses over is just how incredibly individual and idiosyncratic our experience of our bereavements are, individual bereavements of individual relationships. They range so spectacularly. They vary so spectacularly. So there's really no way to kind of arrive at a one-size-fits-all assessment of like, oh, what is technology, quote-unquote, doing to us? But what it has done is it's provided this backdrop against which and through which and in which a lot of our experience of grieving and mourning and loss is set. And so it's completely taken for granted or normal now that we have some interaction, purposeful or otherwise, with the social media and other digital traces of people who have died, because these don't disappear automatically. They tend to stay by default or even by design. And so it's introduced this really powerful player, which is these tech companies and their assumptions and their designers and their way of thinking about things, where they've sort of said, oh, this is the framework in which grieving is happening. These are the rules here. This is what you can control. This is what you can't control. These are the settings. This is basically how your mourning experience in this place, this is how we're going to frame it. And this is how we're going to make up the rules. And so that's such a new player on the scene. You know, it's like this kind of third party or this external party that says, well, hey, mother of this person who's died, actually, no, you're not the legacy contact, so you can't do that. Or, oh, no, you can't access that, or you can't change that, no matter how you feel about it. So they sort of set these rules. And that part is really interesting. So that, to me, is one of the major interesting bits about how social media is shaping our experience of death and loss. It accentuates individuals, mourners' lack of choice and lack of power over their relationship with digital artifacts.
I know that recently I've noticed on the Facebook page that you can make a kind of like a check of like, yes, I want my page to live on if I, you know, pass away, or I can name someone that will own the digital rights to my profile. And I found it kind of interesting because you know how Facebook sends you reminders or memories. They might send you a photo, or you've been friends with this person for so long. And I recently had this experience probably about 6 weeks ago. It popped up in my Facebook feed, an old photo of a friend of mine from 10 years ago, and we had lost touch. And so I went to her Facebook page to see how she was, and I discovered that she had died like 2 months earlier. And I was so surprised. I was sad. I was happy that I got the photo so that I at least knew, and I was able to reach out to her kids, and I was able to kind of read what her last posts were, because it was an unexpected death. It wasn't like from an extended illness or anything. And then it just really kind of stuck with me because I read other people's comments who had the same experience as me, that her photo popped up in our feed and she's such a beautiful, wonderful person. And it was like, wow, this must be happening to quite a bit of people. And I was reading the Oxford Internet Institute said that something by the end of the century that there will be 2 billion dead Facebook accounts. Is that accurate?
It's 5 billion.
Oh my God.
4.9 billion. Yeah. And that's my good colleague, Dr. Carl Oman, who was with the Oxford Internet Institute and is now at a university in Sweden. But he and his colleague, David Watson, modeled this, and they basically looked at using real data from all Facebook users. They modeled, okay, how many dead people would there be on Facebook by the end of the century if Facebook failed, like stopped taking on new people now? I think that might be the 2 billion that you're seeing. But then they had to this other thing where they said, if Facebook keeps growing at the rate that it tends to grow, then how many dead people would there be on it by the end of the century? And that was the number, the 4.9 billion. And the tipping point is somewhere around the middle of the century, where there's would be more dead people on Facebook than living, which fundamentally changes the functions and the economics of the site. That's really interesting, especially when you consider that Facebook tends to memorialize by default its dead users rather than deleting upon death, which was the original policy right up until shortly after the Virginia Tech mass shooting in the United States, at which point people campaigned to Facebook to not delete the profiles of the deceased because they had become places of memorialization for people who were mourning. So that was the really definitive point that Facebook shifted to memorialization, and they've done it in one form or another ever since. That is, again, gonna change matters significantly for Facebook in terms of its business model. And that's pretty fascinating. But what it means, because the dead are kept on there by default in the remembering, that's the legacy contact thing that you're talking about, where you can nominate somebody. There is an option to tick, no, I want this deleted after death, which may or may not be what other people might want. But the person can tick that. Anybody can do this. They can go to the settings in their legacy contact and set these settings. It might not be legally binding in the place where you live, but in most places in the United States, it is legally binding. If you tick on any online platform, this is what I want to have happen, you know, with this information. But it's, what is Facebook's economic model then? What happens, you know, and then what happens to all of the data of all the people on the site, dead and living? And that has implications and historical archive implications for everybody.
Well, I think some of the challenges that I think about, and this happens to all of us, is that we may post something on social media or post a comment that we've completely forgot about from 5, 6, 7 years ago that maybe hasn't aged well. I think that could also happen to people that have passed on, and maybe there's information on there that, say, families no longer want. And I would imagine that Facebook is going to try to hold on to the data and the digital assets surrounding those profiles.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that big data is a very hungry beast, right? And, you know, because some of the applications of a lot of this data are yet to mature, companies like this hold on to data as much as they can in case there's monetizable uses for it down the road that we haven't even conceptualized yet. And so this is one of the reasons I think that the data of the dead don't get jettisoned from a lot of sites like Facebook. But the example that you just put, there was an article just last week, I believe, in the New York Times talking about how people are doing a lot of trolling of anti-vaxxers after they died of COVID. So there's obviously, there are some people who are really strongly against vaccination who have caught COVID and who have died from it, including somebody who was mentioned in the article, somebody who had framed his profile picture shortly before he went into hospital with something that says something like, I don't care if you got your jab, or something like that, something expressing that person's sentiments. And if that person didn't have a legacy contact, that means that profile picture with that thing around it is the profile picture that's going to stay. Because without a legacy contact, those things don't get changed. Those get frozen in time. And I don't know how his family and friends and associates feel about it, but it's certainly something that makes that person more of a target for the people who are doing that trolling and going online and denigrating that person after they die and saying really horrible, cruel things about how they deserved it or other things. Because, I mean, no matter what your stance is, trolling, you know, and cruelty like that, you know, online or off, is not cool. And in my book, even if some people dress it up as a public service or, you know, kind of a education campaign or something like that, cruelty is cruelty. That picture would be frozen. And that includes people who had a change of heart in hospital, you know.
Do you think that we might see people taking Facebook to court to sue for the digital rights, just like when celebrities pass on? If you think of Steve McQueen or Marilyn Monroe, their families own the rights to their digital image and anything, if it's music related or if it's acting related. I work in cybersecurity, so I always think about, like, okay, well, Facebook has access to all these photos through Instagram, and is someone that's passed on going to end up showing up in one of their marketing campaigns in the future?
Oh, absolutely. So the marketing campaigns is one of the considerations for sure. And of course, people who are like celebrities or people who derived their income in life from entertainment are in a slightly different category to people who don't do that. So, for example, the New York law that got signed, I feel like it was in the latter part of 2020, basically said in New York State, at least for a certain period of years after an entertainer's death, somebody who derived their income from entertaining, that their digital image cannot be manipulated, you know, for X amount of time after they die. You know, but again, that's a particular class of person with a particular kind of job. But, you know, with respect to everyday people, exactly as you say, can an image be used in a marketing campaign? Can audio, video, etc. be used to deep fake and impersonate the dead for nefarious purposes? So, for example, presenting to that person's bank as though they are that person. And that's really concerning to me, because thinking about this window between somebody's death and then the time that the family is able to address or figure out the digital portion of the estate, that feels like an increasingly sensitive window. And I'm distressed by the idea that dates of death have a going rate on the dark web and Bitcoin. And there's the reason for that, you know, because there's potential monetization that can happen there if that person's accounts can be hacked and things can be circumvented. I mean, even somebody within the person's own family who's not the executor of the estate could exploit that window, you know? That feels really sensitive to me. It's hard for me to think about the wealth of ongoing, available, rich data that's there without also thinking about identity impersonation and unregulated deep fakes or unregulated things that really need to get regulated so these kinds of things don't happen. I feel like we really need to get out ahead of some of these potentials. I mean, you know, the controversy about Anthony Bourdain in the Roadrunner documentary.
Using his voice, it was like an AI voice, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So initially, when the film came out and when it really came under fire, there were a number of lines in Roadrunner that were created by an AI that was based on the wealth of, obviously, he did lots of programs. So there was all this material that, you know, used to simulate his voice. And there were maybe, I think, three lines or whatever that were created. And at first, the director, who was really ardently defending his decision to do this, said, well, yeah, there's lines in there that aren't him, but I'm not going to tell you where they are. And then I think he got challenged on that, because I've since been told that people who've gone to see the film, it's explicitly identified that it's not his voice. But I think that wasn't originally there in the first cut. I think I'm right in saying, but there was huge pushback on that. And that's quite right too, because to me, that represents the beginning of an incredibly slippery slope.
Another area that I've thought about with the digital afterlife is I read probably a few months ago that Microsoft has just filed a patent for a chatbot that can go through all your old emails and videos and basically craft a personality very similar to you through artificial intelligence, so that when you've passed on, say your mother or brother or husband, wife, children wanted to have a conversation with you, they could, with this artificial personality of you. And supposedly, they're going to be rolling it out within the next year or so.
Yeah, that was announced in January of 2021. And that was really interesting, because the person who was then in place, I'm trying to remember his title, but he was something to do with digital ethics at Microsoft, responded to this on Twitter, because people are, of course, talking about it on Twitter and they were tagging Microsoft in it. And he responded and said, actually, this is a patent that has just gotten through or come to fruition that was put in several years ago, that was filed several years prior. This patent never would have been filed. You know, since then, our ethics committees are much more stringent on this kind of thing. And I can't imagine the ethics committee now passing this. And so, yes, it's disturbing. He said this on Twitter at the time in January of last year. And so I hadn't seen a report recently that indicated that Microsoft actually was intending to roll it out. That might be the case. But it's interesting that the news came out and then there was this denial from someone who, I think he's not there anymore, actually, but at the time he was in this digital ethics position at Microsoft. So again, it kind of shows, though, this kind of unease or uncertainty about the idea that, like, okay, the technology is there to do this. This is the be right back scenario, which is the first episode of the second season of Black Mirror that depicts a data mining of a deceased person's accounts, social media, emails, video, audio, and then the grieving partner is convinced by a friend that it would be a good idea to get the service where she can at first text and interact on audio with her deceased boyfriend, but then she decides to go for the mega platinum service and send off for a highly lifelike android, you know, that can, you know, walk around with her. And then she decides that was a really bad idea. So no spoilers, but she decides it was a bad idea. It wasn't what it was cracked up to be. But so yeah, the technology to do at least the audio, video, whatever chatbot portion of that is there. Just because it's there, that technology, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good idea, including, I think, from a cybersecurity perspective, because I don't think the cybersecurity aspects of this have been sufficiently thought through. Because until we have an absolutely foolproof, fail-safe way of like marking those in an indelible way, those entities that are built, you know, rather than representing an actual live person, I think it's a very bad idea to roll these things out. Because I just worry about how that could be misused. I don't know what your perspective is, you know, with your background in cybersecurity.
Well, I definitely feel like we need an ethical framework for digital rights in general, which, you know, country by country, it differs. But I also think for the digital afterlife, because if you're talking about deep fake videos, which is a concern that comes up on a daily basis, but then also the facial recognition technology and companies scraping social media to take people's photos and then use it in
clear view AI stuff.
Use it in surveillance. I mean, and I don't think that the average person realizes or really thinks about, like, oh, if you have a child now, by the time they're 20, how many photos, how much information is going to be online about your child or your spouse, so that when they go to apply for school, a university, or they go apply for a job, they're going to look at their social media profile, and it's going to be probably creating a similar social credit system that China has that kind of rates who you are as a person. And I feel very strongly that we need some type of ethical framework for the future so that tech companies don't take advantage of it, because they will if you don't stop them.
Yeah. And digital ethics charters or ethical frameworks, that's not strong enough, because what we need is a legal framework that's informed by ethics. Because profit is king and profit is the bottom line for all of these companies, they can purpose wash and ethics wash and everything all they want. You know, a lot of these companies go on about their ethics and, you know, you can sort of say, oh, here's our ethical charter and we're going to sign up to our ethical charter. But at the end of the day, if that's not binding from a legal regulatory standpoint, if somebody couldn't be hauled up in front of the technology digital equivalent of a kind of court of human rights and be convicted, you know, with consequence, then it's not strong enough, because there's no incentive. There's not sufficient incentive or motive for these companies to subscribe to, or at least hold to, whatever ethical charter is around. So it has to be thought about from a legal and enforceable legal and regulatory framework, one with actual powers.
Would that be like the United Nations, or is it a global group? Is it based on countries, just like we have the GDPR and, you know, US data privacy laws are different than obviously the UK, and China probably has one of the strictest data privacy laws right now, which is kind of funny.
That's interesting, isn't it? But the thing is that these companies, well, we think about Facebook, or we think about, you know, Google, other companies like this as being global. And in truth, in some countries, they're not entirely global. They're not universal, because in places like China, there are some countries that outlaw them and have their own platforms, which we often don't talk about very much in podcasts that I might talk on US and UK. But like, so it's not universal, but they cross borders anyway. And they cross jurisdictional borders. And with respect to death, you know, what happens to your stuff after you die, or what your rights are after you die, has been one of the most diverse areas of law there is. It can get right down to, in the United States, county level, practically, in terms of what the rules are, you know, not just to do with like the status of dead bodies, like physical dead bodies and how they're supposed to be handled and rules around that, but things around probate and wills and what's executable in a will and what's not and all that kind of stuff. It tends to be super local. And so then here we have something that it feels much more broad. I guess maybe a good analogy is copyright, like intellectual property, because although there might be some variation, intellectual property or copyright law has a kind of global convention. You know, I kind of feel like it's almost like that there needs to be a really sort of strong template that may be associated with a particular body, you know, like the United Nations or whatever, but that there's a clear template that those countries that sign up to it need to follow. In the United States, there's a model law called RUFADA, which is like something like the revised Uniform Access to Fiduciary Assets Act or something like that. And it has to do with digital assets. And, you know, now almost every state in the union has signed up to, they've modeled their own laws on the RUFADA law. So I kind of feel like we need this strong template, and then we need people subscribing to it no matter where they are, because it's just, it's like super patchy right now. And GDPR kicked the can down the road. You mentioned GDPR, you know, that came out in May 2018, I think. And they said there's some clause in it that says the GDPR doesn't cover the Day of the Dead, and you guys, the member states, you figure it out. Well, that's created kind of a hot mess. So it's just is like, it just doesn't really work. I really wish the GDPR had had more bottle on the date of the deceased front.
So would you say the first step for someone protecting their digital legacy would be on social media, going to their Facebook page and saying, yes, I want my profile deleted after I've passed on, or no, I want to keep my page and I nominate my sister or my husband to own the digital rights to my page after I pass. I'm just curious, because I guess you could do it a part of estate planning, just like you might leave your house or your car. You can leave, I guess, the licensing rights or the data rights to who you are.
And you use the word own, and then you kind of modified it there about licensing rights or whatever it is, because it's really more like that. I mean, like owning the digital rights too might not be quite where it sits, you know, like technically, legally. But the thing is, because of RUFADA, pretty much every state in the US anyway should have people who are knowledgeable about the digital assets side of things, because you can like nominate a digital, you can have like a digital executor overall because of various reforms in the US. So I think it's important to find somebody who's knowledgeable about those sorts of things. But yes, in terms of estate preparation and estate planning, that's one thing that's really important to do. It doesn't mean that everything's going to be able to be as you want it or as you like it. Like, for example, at the moment, you can't bequeath your iTunes library, for example, or your collection of whatever you've bought on a subscription service like that, because it's a one account, one user, and you're only licensed to use it while you're alive, and the license is not transferable. It's almost as though we haven't fully graduated to understanding. We still almost think of a lot of our digital stuff in the same frames in terms of ownership as physical stuff, and the penny hasn't quite dropped. You get a lot of people sort of saying, oh, you mean I can't do that? And people are like, well, yeah, because it's not actually yours. So you can't bequeath what you don't own. So I think there's a lot of confusion around that. Now, with respect to the digital stuff that you mentioned, like social media, I'm really cynical. I'm super skeptical about that, because my preference really in terms of what I think that we should move to, because I'm a fan of moving to a less centralized web and much greater data portability, you know, that's much more than that kind of facilitates kind of a clearer sort of data ownership kind of model where your data is your data and it's not like essentially owned by these companies whose services that we're using. But of course, then all of those companies' business models would have to change, because the economics of these companies depends on them essentially having a free hand to a certain extent with what they do their data. They need to be able to sell it to third parties. They need to be able to monetize it. They need to be able to use it to figure out what to, you know, advertise to you. So it's like, yeah, so everything would have to change basically. But what I would really like is to see a set period of time after a person's, you know, verified death for data to, for it sits on the server to either allow people to do what they need to do with it in terms of estate planning or estate closure, but also to allow people who are mourning and who are bereaved to be able to archive or download easily that portion of the material that they always could see so that they can preserve it for themselves. One of the reasons we try so hard to figure out how can this stuff stay there like safely is because accessing it continues to be psychologically and emotionally important for a lot of people. But then you're essentially asking these social media companies to emotionally look after you in your grief or your bereavement and to sort of do the right thing and keep it up there so it'll continue to be available to you. I feel like that's placing too much responsibility on their shoulders, and everybody needs and wants something different from that material. If it's important to you, you should be able to be facilitated in downloading whatever you're entitled to see or entitled to keep. And then after a particular point, it should disappear and stop doing its bit to heating up the world's servers. And, you know, it's got environmental costs as well, all these data of the deceased, you know, and all this stuff that we're storing ad infinitum. I mean, like, how is that environmentally responsible even?
That's true. So how do you think new technologies like the metaverse, how is that going to impact our digital afterlife? Because I can just imagine, you know, you having avatars of your family members, or of course they're going to have it maybe of celebrities and stuff like that. But I think about the metaverse, and then I think about, okay, Facebook's trying to control that too. And I'm just like, yeah,
it's a dystopian nightmare. It's like, the metaverse is a nonsense. I've got various views that I don't know how sort of blunt I should be about it. But I think this whole thing around the avatars of the dead, and to the point of people fantasizing about actual artificial intelligence trained on the data of the deceased, that has a massive carbon footprint, right? Training an AI, you know, for a deceased person, like a true AI. So first of all, what for? To what end? You know, so we've been dealing with the great cycle of life and loss and death and finitude and bereavement and generations going and making space for the new generations, not just in terms of people, but in terms of ideas, in terms of innovation, in terms of like not getting sort of stuck, you know, in existing in the past. I was thinking about the holograms being trotted out of lots of different pop stars, but I was thinking particularly about the example of Maria Callas. So Maria Callas is one of the stars whose hologram has been created and that toured around to packed auditoria so that people could come and hear Maria Callas sing. And I remember reading one of the critiques of this situation. It wasn't so much about creepiness. It was about the fact that Maria Callas had this incredibly particular style, and she was incredibly influential. Like a lot of people who don't like know opera, like some of the only opera they might have ever heard is Maria Callas, or they associate her with opera. And I'm thinking, okay, so now a situation has been created where Maria Callas can continue to stick around and be influential and be touring around. And how does that infringe upon the space of new artists, of new styles, of new voices, of like innovation and evolution in the opera world? You know what I mean? You think about Star Wars and the Star Wars franchise, which came out in, what, 1977, is it? The first Star Wars movie. And that's incredible, because think about how the Star Wars franchise is still going, right? It's still going. Like, and that's amazing. You know, how long is Star Wars going to continue? And you think about, like, how much does that have to do with the fact that we then were entering in, you know, starting with the 1980s and after, this sort of digital era where it was like possible for these things to kind of stick around. You know, the reason that Marilyn Monroe is still such a major figure is like, think about how popular Marilyn Monroe and her image is on the internet, and how the internet facilitates the ongoing participation and influence of Marilyn Monroe and her image in our world. It wouldn't be here as much if it weren't for the internet. So it's like this whole ideal about the dead being able to stick around and to like continuing to be able to sort of talk to them or interact with them as though they were still here. What is that for? What does that get in the way of? You know, what is the purpose? I want to understand what it's for, because to me, it's hard for me to see the upsides on so many different levels. And one of those are the reasons that I just talked about. But one of the reasons is freaking environmental. Like, who amongst us is so important or so essential to history that justifies the creation of an avatar so that we can carry on? What's that about?
I think it's novelty. Some of it might be ego. Some people, obviously, they can't let go of a family member or someone they loved. You know, also it's kind of like a toy. You want the best Apple phone, or you want to drive a really super nice car like a Tesla. And, oh, okay, when I go into the afterlife, don't worry, I'm still going to be here. I'm going to be an avatar, or I'm going to live on, and my thoughts and feelings will carry on. So I don't know, maybe it'll be more of a If you're wealthy, it's something you might do, or maybe people might do it on an individual basis based on their family. Maybe I'm thinking of like more like ancestry.com. Maybe it's more of a historical aspect if you want to do it from an educational perspective. But I see your point, but I feel like people are going to do it.
Yeah. And the question is, as you're alluding to there, which people are going to do it? Because I'm really interested in how these practices might perpetuate existing inequalities, because it's not going to be somebody in a village in Mali that's going to have an avatar or pay for an avatar to be made of themselves. It's going to be, you know, some rich person in Silicon Valley or in London or an entrepreneur or whatever. And I'm kind of thinking about how you go to, I don't know, Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris, and there's these massive, great, big, huge monuments of all these really rich people. But then there's the pauper's graves where the names don't get marked. And I'm thinking it's like another one of those ways where who is it that gets to be remembered to history? And what's the impact of that, you know, for the rich and the white and the powerful and all that kind of stuff to be differentially remembered to history? That bothers me.
I see that as well. I'm thinking too, like, if you think about funeral services, they're going to look at it as a money-making opportunity, like have a hologram next to your gravesite, or, you know, you have a Zoom memorial service and you get to attend your own memorial service as an avatar. Like, I can see them thinking up all kinds of interesting ideas around that.
Oh, it's already being kind of monetized, these kinds of things. I mean, QR codes on headstones and, you know, and I've, one of the things I talk about in my book a little bit was this experience of sitting with somebody where I was interviewing her about it, and she was talking about finding out about somebody's death on Facebook, and she was going to go to the obituary section of the funeral home, you know, because funeral homes often have websites, of course, where they post the various things. And what we came up against was the obituary of so-and-so has been archived, and you can give a wonderful gift to the family by paying this much, this much, this much to have it like restored for this long, this long, this long. And there's this whole list of tariffs. Absolutely. The upselling of coffins is only the beginning. This is going to be something that is going to be offered as a service, as a good. And what's really interesting about that episode of Be Right Back is it's kind of what happens with a character, with the main protagonist, who was at first horrified by her friend's suggestion that she do it. But then she was basically upsold. You know, she was like really drawn in by the experience. And then there were these like emails asking her if she wanted to upgrade her experience. And in her grief, she decided that she wanted to do that. And then it wasn't what she thought it would be. And it was really uncanny and it was really uncomfortable for her. But she had paid this huge amount of money to do this thing. Business is business. And that's what'll happen.
Overall, in all your research and your studies, what do you think are the benefits and the challenges of leaving your digital footprint behind? Obviously, there's benefits, but there's also challenges as well, just based on your research now.
I think there are benefits in, you know, in that, I guess there's benefits to the, I guess, immediate people who loved and cared for you and want to continue to access memorabilia that often don't find their ways into physical photo albums. Although I'm a big advocate of that, because data loss and maybe not data loss, but loss of data access happens in all sorts of ways. And there's often also not a handover mechanism. Like, there is no mechanism currently by which, for example, somebody's grandchild today will be able to directly access their Facebook profile, because there's currently no legacy contacts of the legacy contacts. So there's no way of handing off that baton that I'm aware of. So it's like, you know, all these things that you're going to think online is forever, actually access could change, you know? So I periodically curate things into physical format that are really important, because I figure my grandchildren or great grandchildren who want to have a sense of, you know, where they came from or what their history is, will probably have a better chance of putting their hands on that than anything that I might post on Facebook or Instagram today. So I think that we overestimate the, I guess, accessibility and permanence of digital stuff. But the benefits of it in the immediate aftermath of the death are that it is available 24/7. It's a conduit potentially to a community of support, you know, of people who also knew the person 24/7. That support is there. That's really important. And I really enjoy being able to access information about, you know, genealogy. It's one of the most popular hobbies in the United States. I think the second most popular hobby in the United States. So there's emotional benefits, there's like meaning benefits, there's, you know, all that. Medically speaking, and again, this is a really contested area around medical privacy, the medical data of the deceased, if it remains accessible, if there's permission to use it, that can be extremely valuable with respect to advancing, you know, science and advancing medicine. You know, there are a number of different benefits, and it's just important to understand our history on a collective level as well. The kind of archive of who, you know, went before is, you know, is important in a number of ways. Drawbacks, though, are kind of some of the stuff we've touched on that I feel like there's a lot of potential if there's not greater regulation for exploitation of various types, including criminal exploitation that affects the estate or affects people as survivors or affects people with respect to reputational damage after they're dead in ways that they can't control. There's lots of ways that family members and loved ones' pain can be increased by unfortunate things that happen in the digital space, like trolling on memorial websites or trolling on Facebook pages or other kinds of digital artifacts that then become part of the person's lasting biography, unless the family is resourceful enough to be able to find some way of getting that edited out. There's that. There's the fact that everybody is so individual in their mourning that they want different things, or they have from a digital archive that's kind of fixed. So there's not very much fine-tuned control that people can have over how a profile appears to them. And so the centralization of it can be a drawback. And I find that the power exerted by the holders of this data, you know, including companies like Facebook, is really problematic because people then, they don't have control. They don't have decisional power, and they're aware of that. And I feel that that's complicated on an individual bereavement level, but I feel like it's generally a bad thing that that kind of power is being exerted by those companies over that data. Yeah, I just feel like it's exploitative and it's unnecessary. I don't like it as a thing. So yeah, that's just a few thoughts about pros and cons.
How long do you think it'll be before they actually set some digital framework together? Obviously, data privacy is a hot topic. The digital afterlife, I think people have a curiosity around it. But when do you think they'll really be like, oh my gosh, we better like put some laws in place to protect people's rights?
Here's the problem. The problem with this is that there are so many different areas of law that are involved, number one. So there's like, for example, contract law. There's laws involving kind of probate. There's intellectual property law. There's privacy law. There's corporate law. There's international law. Like so there's all of these areas of law that have traditionally been a bit more siloed, I guess, and that they've got different practitioners. You know, I have yet to meet the lawyer who is specialist in all of these areas and can draft something that makes some sort of sense. And so it's like going around this roundabout. And every time you're like, oh, well, how about this? And you're like, oh, wait, that's a problem. And you're around, you know, do you know what I mean? Jed Brubaker, who was one of the authors of Legacy Contact at Facebook, talked about his discussions with the lawyers at Facebook trying to figure out ways to do this. And these long, interminable discussions that were just really difficult because it's such a complex area. So I think that we need to really evolve. I feel like the entire legal profession, which of course is going to lag behind technology because technology is so speedy and the law is slow. I feel like sort of more specialist legal areas need to evolve. And I feel like the law needs to find ways to evolve to be more nimble and to enable it to get out ahead of technology. I also think there's a problem with the whole kind of system with the lobbying. I mean, some of these social media companies are some of the most well-resourced and influential lobbies in the United States. So the whole thing of the whole power of lobbying, you know, in the US is a problem. And I guess the lack of, you know, these companies are so powerful, they're almost like non-governmental organizations that are more powerful than government itself. So I think that just so many things have to happen to embolden government and regulators to have the force and the authority to say, no, I'm sorry. This isn't okay. You know, so that's an awful lot of things that have to happen. But the good news is I think that people really are waking up. I mean, with regard to genealogy websites, California in October was one of the most recent states to enact a Genetic Information Privacy Act, which applies to commercial websites like 23andMe and to Ancestry, which really severely limits what companies can do without really explicit and clear opt-ins from the users of these commercial genealogy websites. And I kind of feel like with more stringent protections on things like that coming into force and relating to online stuff and data, that gives me a bit of hope to see things like that happening. And I just hope things will continue on that trajectory. But as I say, charters of ethics are not enough. We have to have, it can't rest with the individual. It's just an individual choice. It doesn't work. Legal and regulatory force is the only thing that is going to work.
My last question is, how do you want to be remembered in the digital afterlife?
I don't presume to predict or know what each individual person who wants to remember me and mourn me, what might be important to them. Because grief is so individual that there's no way I can know what's going to matter to people. I want to leave the autonomy. I don't want to try to control or get all head up about how do I want to somehow enforce or shape people's recollections of me after I'm dead, because that's impossible. That feels like a sort of grasping after control that is a response to the fear of non-being and the absolute loss of control, you know, but it's lovely that everybody can remember somebody in a very individual way, in a way that's their own way. I saw a blog post a few years ago where there were 6 or 7 people who shared a photograph of an item, an object that really made them remember their loved one that had died. And they were completely unpredictable objects. One person was talking about his grandmother's false teeth, you know, that he kept in his pocket. There was a rock, or there was this, or just random objects. And who could have ever thought that that was going to be this key thing that was going to matter to people or be a conduit to really remembering that person? I don't have an opinion about that. I want people to be able to remember me in accordance with their relationship with me and in their own way. And I'm not going to try to enforce a particular way of remembering on anybody.
What a fascinating conversation. How can listeners reach out to you or find your website or your book if they want to contact you or follow you on social media?
Well, my website for my author side of my life, which is probably the one you'll go to if you're listening to this, is elainekasket.com, and it's KASKET.com. And I am on Twitter and Medium as Elaine Kasket. I haven't been writing that much on Medium these days because I've got other projects, including an exploration of privacy from cradle to grave. So that's my current project. But my book is called All the Ghosts in the Machine, The Digital Afterlife of Your Personal Data. It had an original title when it came out as The Illusions of Immortality in the Digital Age as its subtitle. But we thought The Digital Afterlife of Your Personal Data was probably a little bit clearer, less poetic, but clearer. And that is available where all good books are sold. If you don't hate my voice, you can listen to the Audible version of it on your ebook or e-listening platform. A variety of ways of hearing more about it. And there's ways of getting in touch with me, which you can find via my website at elainekasket.com.
Thank you so much for being on the show. I will put all the links to your website and your book in our show notes. I look forward to, is it a book that you're doing about privacy?
Yeah.
I'll look forward to reading it.
Yeah, its working title is Exposed, A Life in Data, or Your Life in Data, rather. And it goes from pre-birth and right like through sonograms and baby valence, all the way up to the things that we've been talking about today, and everywhere in between, catching up intimate surveillance of children and partners, Internet of Things, medical privacy, and genealogical privacy along the way. It should be coming out in 2023.
Nice. Well, I look forward to reading it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You just heard the Age of Aquarius podcast with your host, JC Nova. Remember to subscribe to the show on your favorite streaming platform. Thanks for tuning in.
Age of Aquarius is a Cosmic Media production and recorded in Los Angeles, California. A special thanks to our producers, Georgie Rutherford and Christopher Lang. To learn more about Age of Aquarius, please visit our website at ageofaquarius.fm. Thanks for listening.